crime. Every community suffers from it, whether it's shoplifting a candy bar, defrauding a bank, or dealing drugs as a member of a gang. Kansas City is no stranger to violent crime. In fact, Kansas City, as of 2011, ranked as the 18th most violent city in the United States, according to FBI statistics. But the science of crime fighting is always changing. Technology presents incredible opportunities for police forces to combat crime, using big data and video documentation to make connections and record events as they occurred. But how do we keep police forces accountable with these new tools of crime fighting? I'm Matthew Law Middleton, and today on Central Standard, we look at crime fighting and how Kansas City is at the forefront of this social science. First, the news. Kansas City, a big city rooted in Midwestern politeness and values, a place where people aren't crammed together on subways or jockeying for position on sidewalks. There's clear open air and opportunity for a comfortable lifestyle with a significantly less cost of living than the cities of the East and West Coasts. But be warned, if you live in Kansas City, you're almost twice as likely to be the victim of violent crime than if you lived in New York. But it's not all doom and gloom. Good morning and welcome to Central Standard. I'm Matthew Law Middleton. Today we discuss how we address these challenges, utilizing theories and tools in criminology while keeping our police forces accountable. We're joined now by Dr. Charles Katz, a professor of criminology and criminal justice at Arizona State University. He's literally written the book on policing gangs. It's called Policing Gangs in America. He's also the Watts Family Director at the Center for Violence Prevention and Community Safety at ASU. Thank you, Dr. Katz, for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
So I kind of want to start at really a basic question, but you've done a lot of research into gangs, but what is a gang to begin with? Like, how do we define what a gang is?
Well, that's the magical question that people have been working on for the past 100 years. There's oftentimes not a consensus, and quite frankly, there is not a consensus on what a gang is. But typically, it's comprised of a small group of individuals. We could define a small group in a number of ways. It could be two people. It could be four people. It could be more. But it has to be more than one person. It's a group. It's typically youth, somewhere between the age of 12 to 24. In some communities, it can be a little bit older than that. But in general, we talk about somewhere between a 12 and 24-year-old individual as being the most likely, typically male. They have typically some form of self-identification as a group. It could be the street that they grew up on, the school that they go to, and they are typically engaged in troublesome behavior. And how we want to define troublesome behavior is going to depend upon the type of community that we come from. And what might be troublesome in Kirksville, Missouri might be more troublesome in another community, or vice versa.
For example?
Well, youth hanging out on a corner. Mm-hmm. In some communities, that might be a very normal thing. In other communities, it might make some people nervous. In some communities, you could have a group of four individuals smoking marijuana on the corner, and at some places, may not be more normal.
That's just afternoon.
It can happen, and it really just depends upon the community that you're in and how people what people believe is normal.
Mm. Have gangs always been a part of human society? The more I started to think about it abstractly, I thought about like clans from ancient times, like a group of it's an organization of people with common goals, common principles. But you said, you've been studying this for the last 100 years.
Well, absolutely. In some people's eyes, what might be a gang they see as an organization that protects the community. Mm. That still exists today, especially in immigrant communities where they oftentimes don't have the same availability of resources as the rest of the community. And you have groups that believe that they are looking out for their community interests. And a classic example, when we were working in, we spent about 5 years working in Trinidad and Tobago, done a lot of work in El Salvador. And a common theme is that they feel that they don't have the police services that they should possess. And so as a result, community members will come to the gang leader, say, we need some help. This happened to me. I'll give you a classic example. In one case in Laventille, a priest was asked by an elderly woman. She said, a local guy stole my purse. I don't know what to do. It had all of my money in it. And this was not a woman of means. She was, everything she had was in that purse, all of her cash and, you know, her monthly check that she received from the government. And the priest went to the local gang leader and said, can you help me out? The gang leader said, it'll be taken care of. And by God, 2 hours later, the purse and all the money was returned to the woman.
Do we know how the justice was rendered? Like, was it murder or was it?
It depends on the individuals. If they are from outside the community, maybe nothing. If they're from inside the community and the gang leader has some influence, which they often do, they will sometimes hold a community court. And believe it or not, government officials will show up to that and give it some legitimacy, in which people can be given what they call licks or strokes or be admonished, whatever it might be.
Is a lick or stroke a euphemism for like physical abuse?
A belt, a stick. Think about what was done back in 1930 to kids, and probably that's what they do.
So this was definitely one of the questions I wanted to get to. Like, so, I mean, I think we have a very powerful image of gangs as a corruptive social force, but are there other examples of good social good that they do?
Well, I mean, in some ways, that's an example. In many communities where they don't have access to resources, they can be one of the few sources of income to individuals, whether it's through drug sales, whether it is getting milk for babies, whether it is finding a youth a job, albeit it will most likely be an illegitimate job or illicit job. I don't want to make this sound like that is the normal gang activity, to be very clear.
Yeah, gangs, you know, for America.
It's just not that. It's just not that way. You will have occasion in which they engage in positive or what can be viewed as positive activity, but by far the majority of their activity is antisocial in nature and comes with it a great deal of problems for communities, for criminal justice agencies, for public health, as well as for families and how it impacts families and communities.
Yeah, and, you know, I alluded to this perception of gangs and their influence. You know, it kind of exploded in the 1980s. Can you give us a little history of, you know, the gang culture and perceptions in America pre-80s and then what happened in the 80s through the 90s?
Yeah, the fact is in most communities, the proportion of youth that join a gang at some time in their life has held fairly stable. Huh. Give or take, it's somewhere around 6% of youth at some time in their life will join a gang. Typical duration of somebody's membership in a gang or association with a gang is anywhere between 6 months and 2 years. Typically, people use a 1 to 2 year reference point as the length of time that an individual spends with a gang. And it's typically during this transitional period of their life in which they have a lot of issues going on. Think about all the things you may have gone through when you were a 13-year-old, 14-year-old boy and some of the complexities that come along with it and how you're thinking about your life and what it is that you want out of your life. And so we've seen gangs in this country since they've even made movies about it with, you know, based in New York and
Gangs of New York.
Gangs of New York. And that was written I believe, by a guy by the name of Asbury. He was a newspaper reporter at the time. And in America, that was one of the first depictions of gangs in the United States. But gangs can, if you think about, you have to walk the gang plank, you know, one of the early gangs in history may have been pirates. We don't exactly know when, you know, gangs first started to emerge.
Enterprising individuals and engaged in illicit activity.
Right. They don't have other opportunities and they're moving forward in other ways that they believe is appropriate for them, even though it might not be appropriate for 99% of the rest of society. But the gang problem picked up attention in the 1980s along with the crack epidemic. And there was this strong belief that the drug trafficking network in the United States was largely tied to street gangs, which we now know is fairly inaccurate in terms of organizationally speaking. As individuals, they were heavily involved in the drug traffic, but not necessarily as an organization. And we saw increased attention on them that we hadn't in the past. That was at the same time when the United States started to move towards a different direction with criminal justice in terms of heavier influence on enforcement, heavier influence on repeat offenders, chronic offenders, those who are focusing on violence. Quite frankly, the people that we're most nervous of in society. People that are going to rob you, people that are going to rape you, people that engage in drive-by shootings, homicides. And there was an increased focus on these individuals in an attempt to incarcerate them.
And yeah, you mentioned that it was found that the potential connection between crack cocaine and the gangs wasn't necessarily as direct or correlated as strongly as it was perceived at the time. How do you go about proving something like that as a person who studies criminal justice? How do you even, like, is it just interviews?
Well, it's most of what we do is triangulated. No one study is going to define any particular issue. Society is too large to have the one defining piece of work. But there's been some really innovative work by Cheryl Maxson, Scott Decker, Irv Spergel, Malcolm Klein, in which they started to work with gang members, the police, community members, and learn about why gangs were in their community. And one of the things that they learned was those gangs have been around a long time. It's not necessarily a new phenomenon, but on occasion you do have youth that move into a community and they bring their gang culture with them. And we see a gang culture emerge perhaps in a community that didn't have it. Keep in mind, we've seen a great deal of growth, particularly in the southwest of the United States, over the past two decades. And so we had a lot of migration as well as immigration. And that coincided at the same time as the crack epidemic. And you're talking about gang-involved youth are highly involved in criminality. They're highly involved in drug use. And they're also oftentimes selling drugs. Now, it's not like the movie Scarface, where somebody is making $1 million a day. Most of these individuals make less than minimum wage selling weed or coke or a rock or whatever it might be. But there became an association. And so what folks started to do was try to understand the gang as an organization and as individuals. And what they found was that the money that individuals or these gang members were making was not going to a pot of money. It's not like gang members have a corporate account, put money in a savings account, or even in a hole in the ground as a group. What you make is what you earn yourself, but you have connections to illicit networks that most other people don't have because you have a large number of associates that are involved in criminality. So you already have a built-in network of people who have access to the types of things that might sell on underground. And so these individuals were involved in a great deal of trafficking and street-level drug sales. But the organization itself, we don't want to mistake it as organized crime. Keep in mind, most of these individuals are fairly young. They can't even make it up in time to make it to school or to make it to a job. These people have a lot of issues that they are confronting. And the notion that most of them have the capacity to run an international drug ring, it's somewhat absurd when you meet these people. But that is not to say that you don't have individuals that do, are the exception to the rule. But they are the exception to the rule. They're the minority.
Hmm. And in Policing Gangs in America, you and your co-author wrote about the crash unit in Los Angeles. What was the crash unit and how did it work?
It was one of the early gang units, or operated as a gang unit in Los Angeles Police Department. The Bloods and the Crips were one of the first gangs that really picked up national attention.
I mean, like, they're part of the lexicon even now, you know.
Right.
Like,
talk about the movie Colors, Robert Duvall, Sean Penn. It was all based on that era. And they operated with a great deal of intensity, we might say, in terms of talking to people on the streets, interview them, interrogating them, and taking a much more law enforcement approach towards gangs themselves, not necessarily other crimes. So they really focused on gang members and trying to understand the criminality that they engaged in and trying to isolate those that were the most chronic offenders and arresting them.
But it eventually was shut down because it was found that individuals were abusing their power in the crash unit. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Sure. It's sort of ironic because that keeps happening in L.A., right? You had the crash unit, and then you also had the Rampart Division, which at the center of that issue was gangs as well. And we know that there's a couple of things that may place these gang units at risk for engaging in misconduct. And one of the things is it's a concept that we've borrowed from organizational research. It's called loosely coupled or loose coupling, in which the gang unit in some ways operates as its own police department. They pick up their own culture, their own values. They're physically isolated from the rest of the department. They don't have responsibilities to the rest of the department. They just focus on gangs, typically at a location that is not disclosed to other people. And they have a special mission to focus on these special types of offenders or gang members. So what we find is they're both physically and operationally decoupled from the rest of the police department. This allows them, in some ways, a great deal of freedom. And that freedom can be used for good or for evil, right, as well, Spider-Man said. And on occasion, if you have poor oversight, you have poor training, and you have too much testosterone in a given area, it can be inclined to problems. And that's what's repeatedly happened in some parts of L.A. as supervision and accountability became a little bit more lax than what we would like to see. And also training has been notoriously weak in some areas of the country in terms of gangs and how gang officers should operate.
But two things. It came out of a good place in theory. I mean, it was this perception that gangs are destroying our communities and wanting to rid our communities of gangs. So it came from a good place, but how were they – can you give some examples of why there was that much impetus to make this change, and then what went wrong? Some examples of that in L.A. and also other cities.
Sure. I mean, the the impetus of it is that – excuse me, is that we have a group that engages in criminality that's different than any other group. This group is much more likely to be involved in criminal activity. There is at least some organization to it, and that you have a social network of youth that are hanging out, know each other. How organized it is depends upon the community, but they're typically not that organized. But there is some hierarchy. You do have some individuals that are more respected in the group than other groups. And as a result, the police department didn't really have the capacity, or many police departments didn't have the capacity to gather information or what the police call intelligence on these types of groups, because it's much more complicated to investigate crimes in which people are colluding with one another and working together than to solve crimes like domestic violence, where the offender and victim know each other really well. And so there was this need or call for specialization, and I embrace that. I think that it is the right idea. I think that having intelligence and information and making decisions based on data and information is essential in today's world. It is the way that police departments should be operating. On occasion, though, we have some officers that believe that people don't receive the justice that they deserve or should be treated in a different way than perhaps is dictated by policy. And keep in mind, these are oftentimes young individuals. They're people that have a lot of energy. And keep in mind that the biggest reason why people become police officers is to help people. And sometimes they're helping people can take them in directions that might be a little overly enthusiastic, to say the least, that is problematic and creates more tension and conflict than is helped, and there's been some real problems with that in a number of communities across the country, where officers become overzealous and start to do their own thing and behave in inappropriate ways.
You're listening to Central Standard on KCUR 89.3 FM, streaming live on KCUR.org. I'm Matthew Law Middleton. We're joined by Dr. Charles Katz. He's a professor of criminology and criminal justice at Arizona State University. We're discussing the methods and issues of policing and police accountability. When we throw out a phrase like that, what do we mean?
That's a great question. When you talk to police about police accountability, their first thought oftentimes is dealing with corruption, excessive use of force, officer misconduct of one kind or another. But police accountability that's only one small part of accountability. That would be the equivalent of if we were going to examine the performance of you in this office, that we would only focus on your misconduct, never how you're doing in other aspects of your job and how successful you are. And police accountability is really a holistic approach toward understanding the performance of the police in its many dimensions, not just the problems, but also the many positive things. And we need to keep in mind that just because a police agency has a problem in one area doesn't mean that the entire agency is a problem, but rather that they may have a problem in one particular area, but other areas they may excel in, or You have some agencies that really are just bad in every aspect. But that is truly the exception, not the rule. Mm-hmm. And there's a reason why in most communities police have 80 to 90% satisfaction reports from citizens. 80 to 90% of citizens are satisfied with police services. That's much better than what you get with elected officials. That's much better than what you get, whether it's local, state, federal officials, and many other fields. And that's because the police, by and large, do exceptionally good work.
When we talk about police accountability, do we also mean like how we track the arrests they make, the drops in crime? Is that usually kind of part of that as well, like holding them accountable to, quote, do their job?
Right. One of the things that is difficult is that it's not like we can necessarily hold a police department accountable for increases in larceny, for example. The police are only one apparatus to control crime. As a matter of fact, they're, you know, some people, the coin and the thin blue line, it's the idea that they're the last stand between the bad guys and the rest of society. But in reality, there are a number of mechanisms there that are to address problems in society. We have schools, education. If kids become too disruptive in school, we sometimes have special programs for those kids. We not only have families that are responsible for raising their children, but if families do too poorly, we have mechanisms out there that will try to assist those families in issues. We have religious organizations in which people belong to, and faith-based community, which is very involved in dealing with issues within the community. And then people oftentimes forget about it, but we also have the business side, in which we have the business community has a responsibility not only for addressing and focusing on issues within their community, but also they're the primary economic engine of most communities. And it's opportunities that drive growth. And the more opportunities people have in a community economically, oftentimes we'll see less criminality.
Yeah, in my research, I saw that like in the 80s there's been a bit of research done that perhaps the growth in criminality like in gangs in that period was related to crack, but crack because there was an entire shift in terms of the economy from manufacturing to more skilled labor, and that there was a huge drop off in terms of economic opportunities for particularly youth.
That's what some people argue, and I think that argument has a lot of credibility, and I'm always hesitant to think that one thing explains all of our issues. I wish that the world operated that easily. But we had a number of things that converged at that time, one of which we had not only a destabilization in our economic structure in this country, but we also had a destabilization of the drug market. And
what do you mean by that?
It was all, we had crack introduced to the scene.
Was cheaper, easier to make. And so it meant more people could be involved, more people could use it. But no one knew where to set the prices. And is that what you're saying?
Exactly. Think about when the new iPhone came out and everybody rushing for it. It destabilizes the rest of the market and everybody else has to deal with that. But it also means that there were different corners. People had to determine which corners they were going to sell dope out of, had to determine new rules on price structures and who was getting what. And it basically the chaos broke down because there was no longer any order in how drugs were being distributed in communities. And people don't necessarily think about it, but within business structure, we have some regulation, right? And we have mechanisms that you need to get a business license, you need to have appropriate people. There's all sorts of, whether it's formal or informal rules that everybody understands. Well, it's not all that different in street level drug sales. You may not have to go to the government to get a license, but you sure need some credibility from some people to vouch that you're okay to buy from and that they're not going to run into problems and that you're going to be safe to sell to. And there's all sorts of issues that go into creating a stable drug market in which these people can make money. It's been exemplified in a number of programs, most often in Baltimore through a couple TV shows.
Like The Wire.
Right. Yeah. And if you recall, that was the focus of their strategy was to try to organize the drug market into one particular community so that it wasn't affecting the other areas of it. And that was to structure it.
And is that a policy that police like are aware of and like that they use or don't use? Like it kind of seems like it's a circular game of police figure out a new way of assessing crime and dealing with it. and then it shifts on them.
Well, you know, we hope that they're learning, right? And we're confident that they do. But it's very typical or very difficult to stay ahead of a very free market like that. But a lot of it is determined by the community, and what the community wants is what the community will get. If drug trafficking or street level drug trafficking start to encroach on a part of town where it absolutely is not going to be tolerated, whether it's by businesses, the churches, local citizens, the police will listen to their constituents and will typically try to address the issue in the best that they can.
But could that come like back and be negative in a way to suggest then that like where there is crime or high levels of drug trafficking, like that those communities just simply don't care?
It's not that they don't care. It's that they don't have the capacity to necessarily address it. If you think about some of the most disadvantaged communities in our nation, we have individuals that may be single parents. They're working 12 hours a day. Perhaps they're illegal immigrants. They don't have access to resources the way other individuals do. They're also disadvantaged in other social ways, not just economic, but they're also disadvantaged socially. Their connectedness to the rest of society can be somewhat limited and lack experience. And that's why we see fewer community organizations in some communities than in others. So in the most disadvantaged communities, it's a real problem because they oftentimes don't have a voice. There is no community leader that many communities have. And where we have robust community leadership are those same communities where we know the hope is still alive and we can address those issues. Some academics have argued, for example, the fathers of community-oriented policing argued that some communities are beyond repair and that some are so problematic that the police just simply cannot make a difference in those communities because there is no community to organize and to help. Most people don't agree with that, but it nevertheless has been an issue of great discussion.
We're going to take a quick break. When we return, we'll continue our discussion of how we fight crime, hold our police forces accountable, and how Kansas City is on the forefront of this social science. Central Standard returns in just a moment. Welcome back to Central Standard. I'm Matthew Law Middleton. We're discussing crime-fighting tactics and how they've changed over time. We're joined now by Dr. Charles Katz. He's a professor of criminology and criminal justice at Arizona State University. I want to go back for a moment to what you were mentioning earlier, this idea of police accountability. Is this kind of a new idea, the idea of police accountability, or is it something that's like always been around but we're looking at it more specifically?
It's evolved, I think, is the best way to state it. Back 100 years ago, we had accountability through political influence, and that people that were elected were also the same people who appointed police officials. And so there was a direct link between the public, politicians, and the police, because if a politician lost their job, so did the police officials. We no longer operate that way in most communities. Most communities we've been able to bifurcate politics from policing, and as a result, police are more neutral in terms of their approach to a number of issues, and they're not influenced politically as much as they have in the past. And so over the past, give or take 50 years, there's been an evolution in thinking about police accountability. But police accountability is a little bit different, not a little bit, a lot different than many other facets of society. It's not like business. It's not like we're looking for a profit. It's not like police can necessarily control the crime rate. They're just, like I said before, they're just one aspect of it. But what they can control is how the public feels about them and how legitimate they are perceived within the community. If you think about, we can't just come in if a police department if a community homicide problem just takes off. We can't just come in and say, okay, all of you are fired and we're going to hire new police officers, right? A business might go out of business, or if a manufacturing plant is performing poorly, they can fire the employees or they go out of business. In policing, it doesn't operate that way. You're going to still have those same employees working for you, and so you have to work with what you have. The only person that you can typically address is the chief. And that's why when you see a chief fired, it's typically not because crime is out of control. It's typically because the community has lost faith in that chief's ability to address the problems that they believe important. If you take a look at situations in which a chief was let go. It oftentimes is related to issues of racial tensions in a community. It can be related to issues of corruption that have nothing to do with the chief's office, but everything to do with lower line level personnel, but they were not held accountable. It typically has to do with legitimacy, not for more objective things like crime itself.
It makes me think of the broken glass theory a little bit of crime, which was, I think, suggested in 1982, the idea that, you know, if there were broken windows, like that crime breeds off of fear and instability. And that if you live in a community with broken windows, signs of discord, signals to you that suggest that the community doesn't care, that you then believe, well, society doesn't care. I don't care about society. I'm more likely to break laws. Is that kind of like an outgrowing, or is that similar to what you were discussing?
That's exactly what some people believe. I certainly don't think that issue has been settled.
Why not?
Well, some people argue that disorder is not a symptom, but it's just it exists alongside crime. So it's not as if solving issues related to physical and social disorder will somehow have an impact on crime itself, but rather you're just impacting physical and social disorder. Physical disorder is like the broken windows, houses that are dilapidated or no longer people no longer live in them, and so they become problematic, used as drug houses or whatever it might be. Social disorder is things like prostitution on the streets, troublesome youth hanging out on the streets, noise, loud parties, things that just upset neighbors and citizens that people don't want to see.
Neighbors who don't want to party.
Some people believe that by addressing those problems, it will send a signal that we will not tolerate those problems as well as other problems. And it really took off in New York, and it started with turnstile jumping in subways.
Yeah, Malcolm Gladwell made specific mention of that book in his book, The Tipping Point. And it was like they thought that was what was making a huge difference, is that public displays of even businessmen who jumped at the turnstile, like, we're going to make you an example of you. Crime is not acceptable in New York City. But now, New York has a lower per capita murder rate than Kansas City, than Detroit. It's impressive.
It is. I would be one to argue, though, that it was only partially explained by the police, but that is not the entire story.
One of the other things that's been going on in New York and a lot of police forces is the idea of big data and analytics and tracking crime very precisely, like geotagging it, you know, down to the block, who's being, you know, who's doing what, when, and where. The Nova Project here in Kansas City is using some elements of this. How has that influenced policing and police accountability?
I'll be frank, you fit on a sore spot with me. The police don't use big data. When you're talking about big data, you're talking about information like what Facebook possesses, Google possesses, people that have more information than a laptop can address. The fact of the matter is, people in criminal justice are calling it big data because they're used to looking at a pin on a map. In other industries, we wouldn't tolerate for this level of lack of innovation and information sharing. In the most robust communities, the communities that are the most innovative in policing, they're starting to harness data. They're starting to pull data from various sources and analyzing it. Well, I think you have the Nova program is a classic example of what isn't just what should be done, but what has to be done. You need to take information, understand where crime is taking place, understand who is engaged in that crime, and understand who is in the middle of it, and understand the communication networks that are taking place in the underground and among gangs, among communities. And you need to understand it in more sophisticated ways than simply picking up a phone and answering a call for service and going to it. That is an absolute essential part of police responsibility. They are the only ones out there 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, 365 days a year that you can call and get help. That has to be there. There's a reason why they do such good work, and they do that well. But on the other hand, policing needs to evolve to the point where they're engaged in intelligence-based practices and using data.
And when you're talking about data, are you saying like get warrants to go into people's Facebook accounts? I'm a little confused about like you're saying more data, but I don't have a concept of what that data would look like.
Great question. The police have at their disposal a substantial amount of information. When you make an arrest of an individual, you pick up a lot of information about them. You have their picture. You have where they live, where they work, where they go to school, family members. You get a lot of information with somebody who's arrested.
Particularly if they also post bond, you know who paid the bond.
Absolutely. You have all that information. At the same time, we have other sources of data that can be brought together with that. For example, every time a police officer makes contact with a potential suspect or just an issue that they need to record, like any of us, if we sort of see maybe a problem at work, maybe I need to jot that down just so I can remember it if I need to deal with it in the future. It's called a field interview card or a field interrogation card, depending upon what community you're in. And it's just a little piece of paper, 3x5, in which they record information about it. But within that, they record where that person was at, what they were driving, who was in the car with them, or who was on the street with them. So that's another source of information. You also have information, for example, from gang units. And most communities today have rather elaborate and systematic mechanisms in which how we record individuals who are in gangs and share that information and analyze it.
So like, for example, like if I'm driving with my friends and I happen to witness a crime, like a shooting, no one gets hurt. But like, I sit there, wait for the police to show up, give my, witness testimony, like, and then I get put into this database. And then the idea would be that if I were 2 months later, for whatever reason, like hanging out with the same people in the same area, and I was like also proxy to that crime, like, is it the idea that like then just begin to show strengths, the connection to
exactly
crime?
Exactly. So you may not be directly involved in the crime, but you're involved with all the people who are engaged in the crime. Mm-hmm. And that makes you important. That makes you somebody who has information that might not necessarily be engaging in the crime, but you're very knowledgeable of the crime.
But I might know that Dr. Katz, I've been around him all the time, and he seems like the guy who keeps shooting at people.
Right. And whether or not they want to share that information depends on the relationship with the police, depends on their embeddedness with that particular group. But having that information and understanding that social network within a community is absolutely vital to responding to criminality. And where some of these ideas came from were from public health. And if any of you ever have seen the early depictions of how CDC and others tried to deal with the AIDS epidemic or HIV problem in the country, one of the first things they did was start a social network analysis and try to determine who was the source of origin of this issue and which individuals were they connected to and who else may have the disease and how can we get in front of it. And so it picked up steam in public health. And for instance, with STD outbreaks in schools, they can identify everybody who was involved with person A and take it out and they can
assess risk
and determine whether or not somebody needs medication.
But on the other hand, I mean, disease is like one thing that, but like, I think there are a lot of issues of like privacy and like the police overstepping their bounds. I know in New York, for example, they're having a lot of, one of the big issues in the mayoral election that's coming up is stop and frisk, which was, the idea that police would at random stop and frisk individuals, ask them questions, collect data to ascertain, hopefully to find weapons, illegal weapons or to help deter crime. But there are like kind of social justice issues and personal privacy issues. Where's the line there?
Yeah, I think you hit upon a really interesting point in terms of a boomerang effect with New York City. We're engaged in a similar project in Phoenix. For those that are unfamiliar with it, as a result of the stop and frisk lawsuit, New York City police officers are now going to be required to wear body cameras. And so on the one hand, while individuals argue that they may have had their rights infringed upon them by being stopped and frisked, that may be limited, and that is probably a good thing. But at the same time, now all officers are going to have body cameras on them, and no longer are you just going to have a 3x5 paper trail, but you're going to have a recording of the entire incident in which the police officer made contact with you, showing you at your most intimate time, that when you're being interrogated by a police officer for whatever it might be, domestic violence incident, problem between you and your wife, you and your kids, you and a business owner, and that's on tape. And that's been videotaped. And so what started off as a concern about just being stopped and frisked, there's going to be some accountability. But now is there going to be other concerns about the bigger issue of Big Brother watching everything?
And this gets right back to police accountability. And another issue that, you know, that's pretty complex, which is when is it okay to record police officers? And when is it okay for police officers to record you? You know, to be surveyed. How do we hold the police accountable using our iPhone, right. You know, cameras
right.
at our, you know, that everybody has?
The ACLU out of New Jersey developed an app for iPhones in which you simply hit the app, you record the incident, it downloads automatically to the ACLU as well as, I believe, to the local police department informing them of this. And I could have a couple of those facts wrong. But the basic idea is there are apps being developed just for this issue. Now, in some communities, you have to have two-party consent. And that raises some issues of
you like know. You have to tell the police officer, I'm filming you right now.
And getting their permission, basically.
And I've seen examples of police officers saying, you can't film. You know, and confiscating phones. And what's the legality there? Is that a county by county? Is that a...
It's typically state by state. Mm-hmm. It's shocking that any police officer would in this day and age, say that. In large part because police agencies across the country are very quickly adapting to body-worn cameras in which they're now taping everything because they know everybody else is taping everything. And so this idea, excuse me, of not wanting to get just a 3-second splice, but getting the whole story. And so police departments are starting to get out in front of this and address it so that they have the whole story, not just what somebody wanted to tape on their iPhone. But the issue of whether or not you can or can't, it's complex because if an officer tells you you can't, regardless of what the law is, and they take your phone, what are you going to do about it?
Yeah. Does recording both by officers of, you know, of the public and also public of officers, do you see that as creating more accountability or less accountability?
Oh, I see it as increasing accountability, but I don't think that we understand the unanticipated consequences that are going to result from that shocking level of access that we are going to observe. Most of the time, we are very sheltered from what the police have to do on a day-in and day-out basis and with the people and problems that they have to deal with. Most of the time, most of society doesn't even want to really think about it too much.
For example?
Well, you're dealing with a local homeless guy who has problems with alcoholism and has mental health issues and has problems finding a bathroom and they don't smell good, they don't look good, they don't communicate well. There's absolutely nothing pleasant about that conversation. Experience. Yeah, it's bad for everybody. And all of a sudden, all that information is being recorded and people may or may not, depending upon the community, have access to that kind of information. How is that information? How could it be exploited? These are all things we don't know at this point. But, you know, my fear is that we're going to have the sort of like the real life Honey Boo Boo shows out there, but not the edited and spliced versions. But we're going to see the ugliest side of humanity in all the forms that it comes, and how that might be used to exploit individuals is potentially troublesome.
You're listening to Central Standard on KCUR 89.3 FM, streaming on kcur.org. I'm Matthew Law Middleton. We're joined by Dr. Charles Katz. He's a professor of criminology and criminal justice at Arizona State University. We're discussing methods and issues of policing and police accountability. To return to your idea of big data and police forces perhaps not utilizing it more, like what more should they be doing? How do they grow? And where what's the next step?
The next step is really more systematic information and intelligence data collection. Right now, we have a very small proportion of law enforcement officers that collect intelligence regularly and systematically. And as we come, as officers become more aware of the importance of the information that they're collecting as a collective, not necessarily just one time information, but as a whole, and that information collectively is of great benefit and is increasingly being utilized. And as people recognize it, we'll have more and more officers come on board, and we'll have more and more intelligence, and it will yield better and better results in terms of responding to all sorts of problems.
And do we see it working in places? I mean, I know that the NOVA project is based off of what a program that was very similar in Boston before it came here and saw a dramatic decrease in homicide. It's in Boston. However, that's starting to tick up. Can you explain about how it's working? Where?
Yeah, you have a very sophisticated system in Kansas City. I would argue that it's advanced beyond the work of Boston, and you have multiple information sources that are being used to identify people who are involved in violence and communicating with those people. And I don't want to get into just too many specifics. It's not my project and my place to say, but it is a very impressive project. And what I would argue is a best practice example of intelligence-led policing and harnessing the data that is available. You're not going out and creating necessarily new data. It's just taking advantage of the data that you have and using it in a way that helps you solve problems rather than letting it sit on a computer and not being used.
Yeah, it wasn't until we started covering the NOVA project here at KCUR that I realized there's this whole body of research addressing how we fix this problem.
There's not a lot of people doing it. I think that what UMKC is doing is what has to be done, and that is universities becoming more embedded within their communities, that they become embedded within public organizations, and they help drive decision-making because we have this incredible resource. And believe it or not, private industry pays a fortune for what some of what these guys at UMKC are doing. And we sometimes don't harness that. And they're a cheap resource compared
to... Because they get to do research and publish it.
Well, they also get paid pretty poorly when you compare it to private industry. You know, people don't realize, but when a university charges you for services, even if you are paying for it and they're not giving it to you for free, you're getting it for literally cost. If you go to private industry and ask for a consultant to come in and help you, you get 7 to 10 times cost is the going rate, you know. And so you get these people that are just exceptional, but yet we oftentimes don't harness what they can bring. And I think what UMKC has is a really nice resource for the rest of the community, especially the criminal justice agencies. I hope that what they're doing now continues to grow and build and that UMKC becomes more embedded within public services here because I think they have a lot to offer the community.
I think about how easy it is to commit a crime, particularly unintentionally. The most fracturing crimes like murder, it's obvious you're not thinking. You're not thinking when you pull out a gun because you're drunk and you're arguing with your friend over $30.
That's most crime.
Yeah.
I mean, what you're talking about is what happens. It's not these planned, large-scale, organized crime
syndicates.
Right. That's not the majority of crime. The majority of crime is you going home to your partner and getting into an argument or a dispute with your neighbor. You have to live next to each other even though you hate each other because something happened to your kids. You know, they had a fight. I mean, these absurd things that occur, and the police are the ones responsible, but yet they only have so many tools at their disposal.
Yeah, how are they supposed to anticipate that neighborly dispute or to address it before it even happens?
Right.
And to kind of wrap up here, what do you anticipate we'll see 2 to 5 years down the line in terms of advancements in policing? Like, what are the things that you're researching now that will probably bear fruit, you know, down the line?
Well, I think there's a couple fronts. I think that the biggest one, and I think where Kansas City is at the forefront, and I hope that it invests heavily in this because it will yield dividends for decades to come, not only for the community, but for individuals that live in some of the most violent communities, is the idea of taking intelligence and using it in more sophisticated ways to make decisions about how to allocate resources rather than the old traditional way of just simply looking at calls for service and some of these types of things.
And by that, you mean just responding to
exactly
a 911 call that, you know, domestic violence, a 911 call for, you know, a shooting.
Exactly. I believe that that is... the way in which we're going to be moving forward in the next 10 to 20 years in policing.
And in terms of police accountability in the future of that, what's the best ways to hold our police departments accountable, and where is that?
Well, it's difficult to say because it depends on what the community wants. If the community doesn't want any involvement in accountability, you're not going to have any accountability. That's the responsibility of not only the police department to hold and police its own officers, but it really is a community issue, and the community need to demand what they want from the public. And if the public demands excellence, I have no doubt that they will get excellence. The police officers strive to give the public what they want and to do the best job that they can. But if the public doesn't demand much from them, you're not going to get much from them. And so I think that what we're going to see in some communities is the broadening idea of accountability, really. And we're going to try to, communities are going to increase how they understand what the police are doing. And that will come from more regular use of citizen surveys. It will come, for example, in New York City, where broken windows and other ideas were implemented in the field through community policing. You know, they used offender interviews. So as soon as somebody is arrested, they're interviewing people and finding out, are they getting the message? For instance, questions they would ask arrestees in New York was, are you now less likely to turn the jump style now that this whole strategy has been developed? Is our message saying we aren't going to tolerate minor crime getting across to the offenders and understanding
it? Yeah, do you even realize you're part of this
larger
system?
Exactly. And also, I think we need to think about police agencies themselves and evaluating organizational health. How functional is the organization? Are people happy working there? Are they not happy working there? Oftentimes, police employees get a short end of the stick. Their needs and wants oftentimes come after everybody else's. But if we want good policing, we also need to make sure that our police are paid adequately. We need to make sure that they feel comfortable with their families and how they're going to be taken care of if there's a problem in the case of an emergency, as well as stress that the police encounter and what kind of negative impacts that has on the rest of their family and their lives. And we need to make sure that officers, the agencies that they work for, that people are being responsible about ensuring that it's a reasonable workplace environment.
Dr. Charles Katz, he's a professor of criminology and criminal justice at Arizona State University. Thank you so much for joining us today. This was really wonderful.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
You can subscribe to our podcast, hear this conversation again, or access any of our previous shows from the Central Standard page of KCUR.org. Tune in tomorrow as we explore what it means to be HIV positive today. A lot has changed in the last 30 years. Up to Date is next with MSNBC's Chris Matthews to talk about the bipartisan politics of Ronald Reagan and Tip O'Neill. I'm Matthew Long Middleton. This is KCUR. Thank you.